performing for adoring audiences. And they gambled in casinos that were run by the American crime bosses Meyer Lansky and Lucky Luciano. Since 1952, the president of Cuba, a former army sergeant named Fulgencio Batista, gladly abetted the exploitation of his country by American corporate, entertainment, and gambling interests because he got rich in the process. Batista had held power either in a junta or by himself for most of the years since 1933. He aligned himself with wealthy landowners and the military and allowed American companies to squeeze hefty profits out of the sugar industry. To maintain the allure of his vacation paradise for wealthy American tourists and to generate handsome kickbacks and bribes, he enabled a flourishing underground traffic in drugs and prostitution. The U.S. government supported Batista with military aid and assisted in the expansion of Cuba's intelligence services and secret police. As a pro-American, anti-communist, money-making tropical den of iniquity, Batista's Cuba found plenty of sympathetic supporters in the corridors of power in Washington. Inside Cuba, however, Batista faced a growing insurrection. On July 26, 1953, a small band of rebels attacked an army barracks in Santiago, signaling the start of the Cuban Revolution. The leadership of the July 26th movement included a young and dynamic law student named Fidel Castro and his hardline brother, Raúl, sons of a well-to-do plantation owner. For the next 5 years, Castro and his group plotted and fought against Batista, hiding in the forested uplands of the Sierra Maestra region of southeastern Cuba and enduring the ruthless repression, torture, and murder by government forces of many of their brother revolutionaries. Because of the well-known barbarism of Batista's dictatorship, Castro's revolutionary movement won sympathetic coverage in the American press. Life magazine, published by that noted Cold Warrior Henry Luce, styled Castro a kind of Cuban Robin Hood in one 1957 issue, while denouncing Batista's strong-arm rule. New York Times reporter Herbert L. Matthews scored the scoop of the decade when he interviewed Castro in his mountain hideout in February 1957. Matthews depicted Castro as a youthful idealist fighting for a democratic Cuba. It was easy to see that his men adored him, and also to see why he has caught the imagination of the youth of Cuba all over the island. Here was an educated, dedicated fanatic, a man of ideals, of courage, and of remarkable qualities of leadership. And Matthews insisted, there is no communism to speak of in Fidel Castro's July 26th movement. Instead, the best elements in Cuba, the unspoiled youth, the honest businessman, the politician of integrity, the patriotic army officer, sympathized with Castro and hated Batista's thuggish regime. In the spring and summer of 1958, Life reporters who trekked into the jungle to seek out the dynamic Fidel wrote of the charismatic leader as soft-spoken but confident, a man more interested in building hospitals than becoming president. His brother raised suspicions, however, for he seemed doctrinaire and brutal in his methods. A rail-thin 27-year-old Raúl sported a cowboy hat, mustache, and shoulder-length hair, and toted a machine gun everywhere he went. He seemed partly heroic, partly melodramatic, and partly sinister. Yet both Fidel and Raúl denied any communist affiliation. If we were communist-dominated, Raúl asked the journalist, don't you think they would supply us with all the arms and ammunition we need to defeat Batista? In contrast to these admiring reports about the rebels, Batista's counterinsurgency tactics drew condemnation. His police routinely kidnapped suspects, tortured them to death, and threw their mutilated bodies into the streets to instill fear across the country. They set off bombs in public places and blamed the rebels, hoping to turn public opinion against the uprising. More worrisome for American officials, Batista used the tanks, aircraft, and artillery the United States sold him against his own people, an embarrassing violation of the terms of the arms sales. Under increasing congressional criticism, The State Department announced the end of arms shipments to Cuba in March 1958, signaling a sharp change in the once friendly attitude toward Batista. That same month, U.S. officials began to consider how to ease Batista out of power. As elites and business owners in Cuba turned against Batista's rule, the CIA tried and failed to establish contacts with political groups that might take control of the country in the wake of Batista's removal. This failure frustrated Eisenhower and his top advisors. Discussing Castro, they all agreed that the Cuban rebel represented extremely radical elements, as Alan Dulles put it, and that Cuba could soon be in the hands of the communists. But the United States could not continue to prop up Batista. Acting Secretary of State Herter explained that Batista had lost the confidence of his people, suppressed basic democratic freedoms, and alienated some 80% of the Cuban people, as well as public opinion across Latin America and in the U.S. Congress. Batista had created a very difficult public relations problem and had to go. Despite their grave worries about Castro, the Americans now pressured Batista to resign. On the last day of December 1958, he flew out of Cuba and into exile in the Dominican Republic. A week later, on January 8, 1959, to the roar of enormous crowds, Fidel Castro and his victorious rebel army swept into the capital city and took power. Life reported that the crowds in Havana screamed, "Viva!" thundered applause and flung torrents of flowers when Castro and his barbudos, bearded ones, appeared. The crowds greeted Fidel not as a dutifully honored conqueror, but as a man ecstatically acclaimed by the people he had liberated. American reporters flocked to Havana to cover the rebel leader. Ed Sullivan, the host of one of America's most watched television programs, conducted a hasty and admiring interview with Castro at 2 a.m. on January 11th from a television studio jammed with armed guards. Later that day, CBS News conducted an improvised episode of Face the Nation with Castro from Havana, giving Cuba's new leader an unprecedented chance to explain his revolutionary movement to the American public. Not only the press treated him gingerly, even Foster Dulles, mortally ill and nearing the end of his long service to Eisenhower, proposed to the president that the United States officially recognize the new regime. It is ironic that the era's greatest anti-communist crusader should have advised Eisenhower to reach out to Castro. Yet there was reason to be cautiously optimistic. Castro had named a moderate lawyer, Manuel Urrutia, as the provisional head of state. And despite Castro's fulminations against America, his movement appeared free from communist taint, Dulles claimed. Dulles probably did not really believe that. He simply knew that the United States had lost an ally in Batista and now had no choice but to try to work with and guide the youthful rebel. Tacitly admitting failure, the United States recognized Castro's new government and proffered a cautious hand of friendship. 5. Very quickly, that caution changed to alarm. Just days after Castro's triumphant arrival into Havana, Eisenhower received a report that Castro had ties to Communist Front groups. While there was no present firm indication that Castro is a communist sympathizer, the new Cuban leader did seem nationalistic and somewhat socialistic. Castro appointed a number of well-known moderates to the new government, and remained undeniably popular across the country, but he also allowed a period of bloodletting and vulgar show trials of former Batista officials. Life, which had so recently published flattering essays about the rebel leader, now reported an ugly tide of blood vengeance across Cuba. Lurid photos showed the execution of alleged war criminals following summary trials. "After 7 years of rage, Cubans are now going to make the sadists pay," one article breathlessly concluded. And indeed, several hundred former regime supporters were executed. Castro, once styled a cheery Robin Hood in the American press, now earned a more sinister nickname, The Whiskery Messiah of Sierra Maestra. U.S. officials, perhaps reluctant to admit that a communist revolution had just taken power in a country only 90 miles from American shores, told themselves that Castro could be controlled with the proper tutelage. In their conversations, officials portrayed Castro as a wayward child, a headstrong youngster who needed some discipline. Foster Dulles established this paternalist framework in remarks he made in mid-1958 to his colleagues. Throughout much of the world, and certainly in Latin America, he opined, there had been in recent years a tremendous surge in the direction of popular government by peoples who have practically no capacity for self-government and indeed are like children in facing this problem. Ellen Dulles used similar terms. Cuban officials really had to be treated more or less like children, he believed. They had to be led rather than rebuffed. If they were rebuffed, like children, they were capable of doing almost anything. The U.S. Embassy in Cuba urged Washington to show patience, goodwill, and cooperation toward Cuba, while tolerating the unruly behavior of these Caribbean toddlers. Yet a creeping unease began to settle on Washington as Castro and his revolution took hold. One of Castro's first acts was to legalize the Popular Socialist Party, Cuba's Communist Party, that had been banned since 1952. The State Department worried about reports that Castro's fellow revolutionary, Ernesto Che Guevara, had outlined a plan to export Cuba's revolution to Nicaragua, Haiti, the Dominican Republic, and Paraguay. Che was labeled an extreme leftist who had been acting like a communist since the fall of the Batista regime. Raúl Castro was thought to be even more radical. In late March 1959, Allen Dulles reported to the president that he was disturbed by Raúl's demagoguery and his wild statements. Though the regime was not communist-dominated, Dulles stated, it was clear that communists were now operating openly and legally in Cuba, and that Fidel was moving toward a dictatorship. Far from a Cuban George Washington, Fidel Castro began to look to Americans like a Nasser of the Caribbean. Hoping to dispel the darkening clouds that had formed over Cuban-American relations, Castro seized upon an invitation from the American Society of Newspaper Editors to address their annual convention in mid-April in Washington, D.C. The trip was unofficial, and Eisenhower chose not to meet Castro, hastening to Augusta to avoid him. But the State Department arranged for a packed 11-day tour that included a meeting with Vice President Nixon, Secretary of State Herter, and congressional leaders, as well as a trip to New York and Boston. Castro arrived at National Airport on April 15, 1959, to the hearty cheers of some 1,500 onlookers and a crowd of reporters who were amazed to find him still wearing his trademark green battle fatigues. After meeting with the Cuban leader the next day, Secretary Herter reported to Eisenhower that he found Castro a most interesting individual, very much like a child in many ways, quite immature regarding the practical problems of government. Castro tended to become voluble, excited, and somewhat wild. But Herter thought he was sincere in his desire to work with the United States. In his April 17th speech to the newspaper editors at the Statler Hotel, Castro launched a full-scale charm offensive, speaking in English for over 2 hours in a packed ballroom under the glare of 1,000 flashbulbs. He insisted that his revolution was not communist, that Cuba wanted good relations with America, that investors were welcome to do business in Cuba, and that the United States naval base at Guantanamo would remain untouched. Our revolution is a humanistic one, he assured his hosts. At the end of his performance, the hard-bitten newspaperman gave him a prolonged ovation. Nixon, however, painted a darker picture after his encounter with Castro. In a private meeting in the vice president's office in the Capitol on Sunday evening, April 19th, the two men talked for almost 3 hours. Nixon adopted the paternalist tone so popular with the Dulles brothers and tried to coach Castro on how to soften his revolution and open Cuba up to democratic reforms and private American investment. In Nixon's account of the discussion, Castro defended his decision to postpone national elections in Cuba for a period of 4 years. The people did not want elections, Castro said, because elections in the past had produced a bad government. Nixon described this as slavish subservience to the voice of the mob, and found the Cuban incredibly naive with regard to the communist threat. Castro sounded almost exactly like Sukarno in his assertion that the communists would never be able to infiltrate his government. Nixon ended his report by saying that Castro has those indefinable qualities which make him a leader of men. He is either incredibly naive about communism or under communist discipline. My guess is the former. Yet because of Castro's popularity, the United States could not oppose him directly. We have no choice, Nixon felt, but at least to try to orient him in the right direction. Castro's visit electrified the American public. After leaving Washington, he traveled to Princeton University and then to New York City, where enormous crowds greeted him amid cries of Viva Fidel and Viva el Liberador. The tall, bearded rebel in his olive-drab fatigues repeatedly broke free of his bodyguards to plunge into the crowds and shake hands. In Cambridge, Massachusetts, he addressed a crowd of 10,000 admirers outside Dillon Fieldhouse on the Harvard campus. Still, some reporters had their doubts. Roscoe Drummond of the Washington Post admitted that Castro possessed a friendly, outgoing, almost mesmeric personality. But his hostility to elections hinted at a future tyranny. The Wall Street Journal editorial page likewise worried about Castro's lack of maturity and his emphasis on melodrama rather than substance. The Cuban government looked like a band of very young men who, having fought hard, were a little intoxicated by their sudden success. Inside the State Department, Herter's staff tried to assess the new Cuban strongman. Castro's power to sway world opinion, they thought, was not charming, but dangerous. His personal magnetism might blind the public to the true radicalism of his regime. Far from being a child or ingenue, Castro was a strong personality and a born leader of great personal courage and conviction. With such enormous political gifts, Castro spelled trouble. It would be a serious mistake to underestimate this man. 6. Few did. Yet the attention of the administration in the summer of 1959 was drawn elsewhere. The Berlin crisis, Nixon's trip to the USSR in July, followed by Khrushchev's passage across the country in September, and Eisenhower's personal hopes for a thaw in U.S.-Soviet relations, these issues preoccupied the White House. Eisenhower pushed Cuba to the back burner. Even so, the temperature continued to climb. Reports out of Cuba painted an alarming picture of Castro's post-revolutionary purges. Civil prisoners jam Cuban jails, was a headline in the New York Times in February 1959. Red's alleged role in Castro's regime alarming Havana, blared another in April. Castro's constant public criticism of the United States and the whipping up of extreme nationalist spirit had left the middle classes uneasy, the paper reported. In May, the Castro government announced an ambitious program of land reform, proposing to nationalize utilities, many owned by American companies, and seized the large agricultural estates that produced Cuba's lucrative sugar crop. The government promised compensation, but American landowners and industrialists sent outraged envoys to Washington, demanding Eisenhower suspend the purchase of Cuban sugar as retaliation. Secretary Herter now considered Cuba a danger to all of Latin America, and told the National Security Council the fire would spread very fast if they did not act. In June, Che Guevara launched a heavily publicized world tour to curry favor with non-aligned nations from Yugoslavia to Egypt, India, and Indonesia. Meanwhile, the U.S. Embassy in Havana, which initially had adopted a friendly and tolerant view of Castro, acknowledged that though not a communist himself, Castro had allowed the Communist Party to flourish. His government was following a course which we believe favors communist objectives. Domestic politics also played a role in keeping pressure on Eisenhower. In the summer of 1959, Senator Eastland, the Democratic chairman of the Judiciary Committee, opened hearings on what he called the communist threat to the United States through the Caribbean. Designed to embarrass the administration for its lax attitude to communism in the region, Eastland's committee gave a platform to various exiles and disgruntled anti-Castro figures. One hearing featured the testimony of Major Pedro Luis Diaz Lantz, the former head of the Cuban Air Force. Having fled Cuba 2 weeks earlier under threat of arrest, Diaz Lantz vividly described the grip of communism upon Castro's government, and especially on Raúl Castro and Che Guevara. He pointed to the penetration of communists into all facets of Cuban politics and society. His testimony was made even more dramatic because it was interrupted by a bomb scare, forcing Eastland to clear the room. These revelations by a former Cuban insider embarrassed the administration, and Eisenhower tried to deflect the matter at his June 15th news conference. As to accusations that Castro's regime was communist, Ike said, "The United States has made no such charges." Eisenhower's political rivals took note of his slowness to ring the alarm. Just 3 days later, Eastland invited Sproul Braden to testify before his committee. Braden, a former U.S. ambassador to Cuba, Colombia, and Argentina, and a man who nourished McCarthy-like conspiracy theories about communists in the State Department, announced that, unless eradicated, Castro's regime will convert the Caribbean into a red lake. By midsummer, Eisenhower was starting to feel the political heat from Cuba. Castro gave his critics in the United States plenty of ammunition. On July 18th, he forced the moderate President Urrutia to resign after he mildly criticized communist activities in Cuba. More shocking to American observers, Castro replaced Urrutia with Osvaldo Dorticós Torrado, a longtime leader of the Cuban communists. The U.S. press howled. Life, once so enamored of Castro, now asserted that he had clobbered democracy, and by his violent and irresponsible attacks against a moderate anti-communist like Urrutia, had served the Kremlin beautifully. Castro seemed set on a confrontation with the United States. The breaking point came in late October 1959. On October 21st, in an act of defiance and desperation, Major Diaz Lantz, who had denounced Castro before the Senate Judiciary Committee, commandeered a B-25 aircraft from an airfield at Pompano, Florida, flew it to Havana, and dropped thousands of anti-Castro leaflets over the city. How he pulled this off with no evident U.S. government support remains a mystery. Cuban anti-aircraft fire from the ground missed Diaz Lantz's plane but fell into the crowded streets below, killing three people. The leaflet dropping, which embarrassed American officials, gave Castro more fuel for his anti-American campaign. He denounced this bombing of Havana and alleged that a conspiracy was afoot in the United States to overthrow the Cuban government. On October 26th, Castro staged a mass loyalty rally in Havana. Before hundreds of thousands of listeners, he mocked the official denials from Washington. "How is it possible," he wondered aloud, "that the authorities of a nation so powerful, with so many economic and military resources, with radar systems which are said to be able to intercept even guided missiles, should admit before the world that they are unable to prevent aircraft from leaving their territory in order to bomb a defenseless country like Cuba?" Hailing his own reforms and likening the attack to that on Pearl Harbor, Castro incited roars of anti-American hatred among his adoring audience. The once sympathetic American ambassador, Philip Bonsall, found Castro's foaming, screeching performance reminiscent of Hitler at his most hysterical and most odious. The events of that week in October marked a decisive turning point. American officials now irreversibly shifted against Castro and his government. Alan Dulles asserted in an NSC meeting on October 29th that the threat of extremist control is worse than ever, that Raúl Castro had taken over the armed forces and all moderate voices had been snuffed out. In early November, Secretary Herter summarized the state of U.S.-Cuban relations in a memo for Eisenhower. He claimed that while Washington had shown great restraint in the face of provocations, Castro had gone too far. He fomented anti-American sentiment across the Caribbean, allowed the infiltration of communists into his government, imposed statist economic doctrines on the country, and held out a model of defiance toward the United States that could inflame other Latin American countries. Herter proposed a new basic policy toward Cuba, the encouragement of an anti-Castro opposition that could, in due course, unseat the Cuban strongman. Eisenhower approved the plan on November 9, 1959. The wheels now began to turn quite rapidly within the CIA. On December 11th, Alan Dulles received a memo from J.C. King, his chief of the Western Hemisphere Division, describing a plan to bring about the overthrow of Castro within 1 year and his replacement by a junta friendly to the United States. The program would rely on clandestine radio propaganda, the jamming of Cuba's own radio broadcast capabilities, and the formation of anti-Castro groups that would establish by force a controlled area within Cuba. King went one step further, asking that thorough consideration be given to the elimination of Fidel Castro. Alan Dulles personally edited this memo, deleting the word elimination and inserting removal from Cuba. The modification is significant, but the conclusion remains the same. By December 1959, the United States had settled on a plan to oust Castro by covert means. On January 8, 1960, Alan Dulles directed Richard Bissell to organize a special task force to implement the Castro operation. Bissell, the well-heeled Yale man who had earned plaudits for successfully directing the U-2 spy plane operation, had recently been named Deputy Director for Plans, the director, in effect, of all the covert activities around the globe. To mount the Cuba operation, Bissell created Branch 4 of the Western Hemisphere Division and tapped Jacob D. Esterlein, an OSS veteran and a leading player in the 1954 Guatemala coup, to run it. As they hammered out the details, the plotters focused on infiltrating specially trained Cuban exiles into Cuba, where they would set up underground networks along the lines of those in Europe during World War II, Bissell later recalled. They wanted to establish safe houses, supply depots, and a reliable network of operatives to sustain the budding resistance movement. Initially, the CIA thought they could make this work with 100 to 200 trained operatives who could in turn teach sympathetic Cubans the necessary techniques of subversion and sabotage. How much did Eisenhower know about these plans? It is tempting to assume that Alan Dulles and Richard Bissell were pushing ahead on their own, hoping to shape the Cuba operation and present it more or less fully formed to the president at the appropriate moment. But the recently declassified minutes of the 5412 committee suggest that Ike was in the know all the way. The regular meetings of the 5412 committee obliged Dulles to update Gordon Gray, Eisenhower's national security advisor, about ongoing covert plans. Gray then informed the president. Gray frequently told the members of the committee that he had spoken to his associate about the topics the group had covered, careful never to mention the president by name. This created a protective buffer around Eisenhower, allowing him to deny any direct knowledge of the committee's discussions while remaining firmly in control. Eisenhower knew then that the group had discussed the start of an anti-Castro radio propaganda operation using transmitters that would be installed on the American-controlled Swan Island in the Caribbean Sea. Eisenhower also knew that in January 1960, the anti-Castro programs picked up speed, moving from propaganda to group plotting. On January 13th, Dulles announced to the 5412 committee that, over the long run, the U.S. will not be able to tolerate the Castro regime in Cuba, and suggested that covert contingency planning to accomplish the fall of the Castro regime government might be in order. In fact, this planning was already underway. Dulles said he did not have in mind a quick elimination of Castro. He wanted to enable responsible opposition leaders to get a foothold. The 5412 committee approved, and the planning went into high gear. This scheme, to promote opposition to Castro and eventually to oust him from power, met with Eisenhower's approval. Speaking privately with Herter on January 23rd, Eisenhower said Castro was going wild and harming the whole Latin American structure. Perhaps a blockade of the island might be needed. He went on to say, "Dictators devoted to fomenting disorder can have a terrible influence on our affairs. If it were not for the sensitivity of other Latin American states to U.S. intervention," Ike said, "he would like to begin building up our forces at Guantanamo." Such remarks indicate Eisenhower's eagerness for a confrontation with Castro. 2 days later, in a conversation with Ambassador Bonsall, who had been recalled from Havana, Eisenhower responded to the litany of Castro's anti-American actions by saying, "Castro begins to look like a madman." In February, the CIA planners tried to give more precise detail to their plans to destabilize Cuba. They proposed intensified radio broadcasts, sabotage of sugar mills by Cuban assets, the interruption of Cuba's oil supply, and additional U.S. forces at Guantanamo in case the president ordered direct intervention to save American lives and property. Gordon Gray reported these measures to Eisenhower, who wondered why we were thinking of something on such a narrow basis. He said he wondered why we weren't trying to identify assets for this and other things as well across the board, including things that might be drastic. Eisenhower wanted a bolder plan for Cuba, and he wanted to approve it personally. Before any plans were launched, he said, the 5412 committee had to fully approve, and he himself would like to be involved. Far from delegating these matters, Eisenhower had taken a personal interest in the Cuba operation. At the end of February 1960, Eisenhower undertook a 2-week tour of Latin America with visits to Brazil, Argentina, Chile, and Uruguay. This trip formed part of the Hagerty plan for exposing Eisenhower to the world and demonstrating his global prestige. Ike came bearing promises of increased American aid, and he quietly stressed to his host his displeasure with trends in Cuba. In Rio, he met with a roaring welcome, but his heart sank when he saw a placard reading, "We like Ike. We like Fidel, too." Wherever he went, crowds swelled as people strained to get a glimpse of him. But he also sensed the seething unrest not far beneath the surface. In Montevideo, Uruguay, his motorcade drove down a main avenue whose air was filled with tear gas that had been used to chase away unruly protesters. During his trip, Eisenhower insisted to his hosts that the United States would not intervene in their local affairs. As he put it in his 1965 autobiography, he knew that memories of such interventions in the era of gunboat diplomacy still burned red hot, and asserted that since the 1930s, intervention as an American policy had gone into the discard, replaced by the policy of the good neighbor. This statement is wholly false. The Guatemala intervention against Arbenz in 1954 contradicted Ike's claim. So too did his Cuba policy, whose details were being hammered out at the very moment he was on his tour of Latin America. 3 days after his trip, he met with the National Security Council to review the Cuba planning. Once again, Alan Dulles went through a long list of Fidel's anti-American activities, concluding that the United States could never hope to work with a Cuba dominated by Castro and his associates. Douglas Dillon, the Undersecretary of State, chimed in, "Our objective is to bring another government to power in Cuba." However, Dillon cautioned the group that an overt U.S. intervention in Cuba would help the Soviets and be held up as a counterpart of Soviet intervention in Hungary. The implication was clear. America's role in the anti-Castro plot had to remain invisible. 1 week later, the president gave formal approval to a CIA plan to oust Castro from power and replace him with a pliant pro-American junta. At a meeting at 2:30 p.m. on March 17, 1960, following a briefing by Alan Dulles, Eisenhower approved a program of covert action against the Castro regime. A policy memorandum dated March 16 that had been drafted and vetted in the CIA and in the 5412 committee while the president was on his Latin American trip. The memo was not lengthy. It outlined four parts of the anti-Castro program: to create a popular Cuban opposition as an alternative to Castro, to develop an extensive broadcasting capability within Cuba so the opposition could communicate with the Cuban people, to build a covert network inside Cuba to assist in destabilizing the regime, and to prepare a paramilitary force assembled outside Cuba to be available for immediate deployment into Cuba to organize, train, and lead resistance forces recruited there both before and after the establishment of one or more active centers of resistance. Ike approved the plan, saying he knew of no better plan for dealing with the situation. He demanded the strictest security. Everyone must be prepared to swear that he has not heard of it. He wanted to be kept informed of every detail, but he insisted, "Our hand should not show in anything that is done." This was the fateful moment. The plan marked the start, and only the start, of a long campaign of deception and subversion in an effort to destroy Castro and his regime. Certainly the plan did not yet envision an amphibious landing on Cuban beaches of the kind that was eventually attempted at the Bay of Pigs in April 1961, in Kennedy's first months in office. However, it put into motion a planning structure that led directly to that botched and tragic event. Eisenhower failed to anticipate that covert operations, once started, have a curious way of expanding until they take on a life and momentum of their own. Under pressure of world events, the small-scale infiltration operation sketched out in March 1960 soon grew into something bigger and altogether more dangerous. Chapter 18. U2. The embarrassment to us will be so great if one crashes. 1. Eisenhower had come to rely heavily on the CIA to implement actions that he believed would serve American interests. Arming friends and destroying enemies. That is what the CIA could and did do, and Eisenhower fully supported these actions. Signing off on the ambitious Cuba operation, he demonstrated his confidence in his spies and saboteurs. As it turned out, this confidence was misplaced. For in the spring of 1960, just as Eisenhower approved the Cuba plan, he received another CIA request to launch a series of overflights of Soviet territory by a U-2 spy plane. Against his better judgment, and under intense and sustained pressure from his intelligence and military advisors, he allowed the flights. It was a disastrous decision, perhaps the worst of his presidency, and it requires a careful explanation. Ever since he took office, Eisenhower had accepted, but never resolved, the fundamental tension between his covert operations and his foreign policy. He wanted to pursue a bold public agenda of peacemaking and détente with the USSR. He and his advisors had made great efforts in laying the groundwork for a summit meeting of the four great powers that was scheduled for May 16, 1960, at which he hoped to win agreements on the thorny issues of disarmament, nuclear weapons testing, and Berlin. He wanted to thaw out the rigidity between the two sides, he told his defense officials in February, or there would be a disaster in the world. Khrushchev's visit to America set the stage, and Ike had traveled across the globe in 1959 and early 1960 to Asia, India, the Near East, and Latin America spreading the gospel of peace and understanding. His own trip to the Soviet Union had now been scheduled for June 10th, and it would surely be the crowning achievement of his presidency. At the same time, Eisenhower built a huge nuclear deterrent, ordered hundreds of nuclear-armed bombers into production, approved aggressive covert actions across the world, and allowed numerous overflights of the USSR that violated Soviet airspace, a defiant intrusion that he himself had said was tantamount to an act of war. How could Eisenhower square these two sets of policies? Was he a man of peace or a man of war? He refused to settle the question. And on May 1, 1960, he paid the terrible price. While Eisenhower actively supported the use of aggressive covert operations to destabilize unfriendly governments around the world, he had always been deeply cautious about the use of the U-2 airplane over Soviet territory. From his first flight over Russia on July 4, 1956, Eisenhower recognized that the U-2 flights were intrusive and illegal. If ever one of the aircraft was intercepted and shot down, the Cold War might take a sudden, sharp turn for the worse, possibly even toward war. Yet the U-2 flights supplied invaluable and extraordinary intelligence about Soviet military capabilities. In the era of intercontinental ballistic missiles, Eisenhower feared the possibility of a surprise attack, a nuclear Pearl Harbor, that could wipe out the country in a single strike. The U-2 provided the best available means to learn about Soviet missile and bomber production and to gauge the Soviet ability to harm the United States. Eisenhower accepted overflights of the USSR because he believed the benefits of having detailed knowledge of Soviet missile capabilities outweighed the risks. And so in 1956, he permitted 6 U-2 flights over Russia. In 1957, as the Soviets were making their great breakthroughs in missile technology, he approved 13 more U-2 flights there, flights that yielded a trove of data proving that the Soviets had not yet developed an operational ICBM. Through 1957, then, the U-2 had been a huge success. In fact, it was the greatest American intelligence achievement since the cracking of the Japanese codes on the eve of the Battle of Midway in 1942. Even so, Eisenhower grew increasingly anxious about the overflights. Although the planes flew too high to be intercepted by Soviet missiles or fighter planes, Soviet radar did locate and track each of these flights. The Soviet government privately protested these overflights each time they occurred, making it impossible for the Americans to pretend these were simply off-course weather aircraft. Eisenhower knew that each flight provoked deep resentment in the Kremlin, and surely egged on the Soviets to improve their air defenses. It was a matter of time, he knew, before something went wrong. At the start of 1958, Eisenhower therefore put the brakes on U-2 overflights of Soviet territory. The Air Force continued to fly regular missions just off the Soviet border, gathering electronic intelligence. In January, he told Foster Dulles and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Nathan Twining, that he was worried overflights could lead to a serious and justifiable Soviet reaction, perhaps an attack on Berlin. Eisenhower approved one flight in March 1958 and then refused to allow any further flights for a full year. Meeting with his Board of Consultants on Foreign Intelligence Activities in December, at the start of the Berlin crisis, he said he doubted that the intelligence which we receive from this source is worth the exacerbation of international tensions which results. By late 1958, the United States knew a great deal about Soviet missiles, enough to rebut the panicky congressional claims of a missile gap. Ike concluded that there should be a re-evaluation of the U-2 program. In 1959, his advisors continued to press for more flights, but Ike continued to refuse. In February, Defense Secretary McElroy, his deputy Donald Quarles, and General Twining asked the president to reconsider his opposition. They insisted that without hard facts, the congressional outrage over the alleged missile gap would continue, and demands for greater defense spending would soon follow. In any case, they said, the military had provided assurances that no U-2 would be shot down. Ike held his ground. He preferred to wait until the Corona satellite had become operational. The U-2 planes constituted an undue provocation, he said. Putting himself in Khrushchev's shoes, he thought, nothing would make him request authority to declare war more quickly than the violation of our airspace by Soviet aircraft. His intelligence advisors kept up their campaign. On April 3, 1959, Alan Dulles, accompanied by McElroy, Quarles, and Twining, once again asked for a round of U-2 overflights. Dulles called the data the U-2 provided about as high in importance as any intelligence we can get. Eisenhower stressed the risks involved, the psychological impact on Khrushchev of our flying such a mission at this time would be very serious. We are currently in a state of negotiation over the Berlin crisis, which threatens to be the most serious of our crises to date. The State Department was optimistic, he said, about negotiations on Berlin. Putting a U-2 plane over the Soviet Union now would be needling Khrushchev. The gathered advisers insisted that the Soviets did not have the aircraft or the surface-to-air missiles to intercept the U-2. The plane was relatively safe, they said, and produced test results showing that even the best American jet fighters could not catch a U-2. Eisenhower agreed to think about it, but 4 days later, on April 7th, he called McElroy and CIA Deputy Director Bissell to the Oval Office and told them once again he would not approve. The U-2 flights would jeopardize any hope of a negotiated settlement with the USSR on Berlin. We cannot, in the present circumstances, afford the revulsion of world opinion against the United States that might occur. Eisenhower admitted that he wanted information on Soviet missiles, not least to counter the demagoguery of certain U.S. senators who asserted that America had fallen behind in the missile race. But he kept coming back to the damage if a plane should be shot down. There would be terrible propaganda if the Soviets caught the United States in the act of spying. Yet under repeated assault by his top staff, Eisenhower finally approved one more overflight of the USSR, which took place on July 9, 1959. That flight yielded excellent results, photographing the Turatam missile range and showing how much that site had expanded in the year since it had last been examined. But in light of the upcoming Khrushchev visit in September, the president refused to approve further flights. Alan Dulles, increasingly frustrated that he had to testify before Congress with inadequate data on Soviet missile production, impaneled an ad hoc committee of senior advisors under the chairmanship of Lawrence A. Hyland, a leading electrical engineer and general manager of Hughes Aircraft, to review the state of intelligence on Soviet missiles. Although the Hyland panel concluded that the Soviet program was not as large as many in Congress claimed, it nonetheless demanded more U-2 flights to settle the matter. Positive evidence, the panel concluded, continues to be missing. The panel pointedly called the lack of data alarming. Bissell felt the panel's conclusion would add fuel to the fire in his campaign to get more U-2 flights approved. As long as the spirit of Camp David hung in the air after Khrushchev's visit, Eisenhower continued to steer clear of the U-2, lest he return the Cold War to the deep freeze. But in January 1960, the CIA's campaign to get Eisenhower's approval for more U-2 overflights intensified. On January 14th, Khrushchev gave a speech to the Supreme Soviet announcing heavy troop reductions for the Red Army to be compensated for by corresponding increases in Soviet missiles. Astonished at Khrushchev's claims of a huge nuclear arsenal that could replace the need for airplanes, submarines, and infantry, CIA analysts sounded the alarm. They saw it as a matter of great urgency to verify or disprove these boasts. Robert Armory, the deputy director for intelligence, shot off a heated memo to Alan Dulles, calling for more overflights on a most urgent basis, declaring, "The identification of Soviet operational ICBM sites is the highest priority national intelligence objective." Adding fuel to the fire, Joseph Alsop launched a blistering six-part series of columns on the missile gap crisis, prophesying that Soviet nukes could wipe out all American missile sites in a blitzkrieg strike, a and the United States could do nothing to defend itself, all because of Eisenhower's failure to take serious emergency measures. America was courting disaster, Alsop shrieked. Pearl Harbor was the result, the last time the American government based its defense posture on what it believed a hostile power would probably do, and not on what the hostile power was capable of doing. Eisenhower was running a hair-raising risk. Eisenhower received a more sedate version of this message on February 2nd from members of his Board of Consultants on Foreign Intelligence Affairs. On this board served two men of impeccable national security credentials and vast experience, General James Doolittle, the heroic aviator and the man who had chaired Ike's review panel of the CIA in 1954, and General John Hull, a three-star general and former deputy chief of staff of the U.S. Army. These distinguished soldiers now pressed Eisenhower to authorize more overflights of Soviet missile sites, stressing that the window on the U-2 was closing, as Soviet interceptor aircraft and missiles were getting more sophisticated every day. Ike responded in a manner that reveals the heavy weight of the burden he carried. Such a decision is one of the most soul-searching questions to come before a president. By now, the State Department had settled on the date of May 16th for a full-scale summit meeting with the Soviets, French, and British in Paris. The agenda would include Berlin, nuclear testing, and disarmament. For Ike, the stakes were high, as a breakthrough in Paris could cement his legacy as a peacemaker. Under pressure from his intelligence advisors to launch a new round of U-2 flights, he resisted, knowing he had one tremendous asset in a summit meeting. That is his reputation for honesty. If one of these aircraft were lost when we are engaged in apparently sincere deliberations, it could be put on display in Moscow and ruin the president's effectiveness. He concluded, "The embarrassment to us will be so great if one crashes." This proved a remarkably prophetic statement. Despite his reservations, Eisenhower buckled under the intense pressure placed on him by the intelligence community and approved a U-2 flight for February 10, 1960. The constant demands had worn him down. And just days after the February 10th flight, Dulles was at it again, asking for four more flights. The CIA was a hungry beast whose appetite grew with eating. The president approved one more. Dulles complained, and eventually he got two flights approved. Because of problems with weather and with the Pakistani government, which had to approve the use of its airfield in Peshawar, the flights were pushed back to April 9th and May 1st. Richard Bissell later admitted that by the start of 1960, the CIA knew that Soviet surface-to-air missiles were improving and might be able to reach the high-flying U-2, especially if the USSR knew in advance where the U-2 was going to fly. The April 9th flight, which brought back more detailed photographs of the missile sites at Semipalatinsk and Tulyatam, was tracked even before it entered Soviet airspace. Although Soviet aircraft and missiles failed to intercept the plane, its exact course and point of origin were well known to the Soviets, putting them on guard for aircraft entering their airspace from Pakistan. Bissell should have alerted the president to this fact. He didn't. Why did Eisenhower approve these two overflights, the second of which would take place just 2 weeks before the summit meeting in Paris, scheduled for May 16th? Clearly, the long and intensive campaign by the intelligence community and the military put significant pressure on him. Dulles and Bissell had allies in Joint Chiefs Chairman Twining, Secretary of Defense McElroy and his successor Thomas S. Gates, Jr., Secretary of State Herter, the analysts within the CIA, the Independent Board of Consultants on Foreign Intelligence Affairs, even Ike's most trusted wingman, General Andrew Goodpaster. All had at various times urged Ike to use the U-2 more aggressively. They told him that the nation's security depended upon the intelligence these flights yielded, and that the planes were all but invulnerable to Soviet interception. It would have taken superhuman rigidity to resist this kind of pressure. Then, too, domestic politics played a significant role. Congress repeatedly hauled in Alan Dulles to testify on the Soviet missile program. Because he could not reveal the source of his information, he was often evasive. His lack of clarity and specificity enraged key Democratic senators Stuart Symington and John Kennedy, who alleged that the administration had become soft on defense and had failed to keep up with the USSR. If Ike could prove the missile gap was phony, he could stifle partisan criticism. Finally, Eisenhower liked to gamble, and he especially liked to gamble when he knew what cards his opponent was holding. The U-2 promised to give him priceless knowledge about the true state of Soviet missile and bomber capabilities. Going into the summit meeting in Paris, where Ike would confront a confident and blustering Khrushchev, such knowledge would give him an enormous edge. It was just too tempting to resist. On May 1st, a U-2 plane, piloted by a highly experienced veteran of the program named Francis Gary Powers, took off from Peshawar on a course that would take him over some of the most sensitive and secret sites inside the Soviet Union, en route to Norway. It was the 26th U-2 penetration of Soviet airspace, and it would be the last. 2. Just a few minutes before 9 a.m., Moscow time, a Soviet SA-2 surface-to-air missile exploded just behind Powers' aircraft as it passed over the city of Sverdlovsk. The force of the blast violently shook the fragile U-2, and Powers lost control of the plane, which began to break up and then went into a death spiral. Powers hastily ejected, opened his parachute, but failed to initiate the explosives that were designed to destroy the aircraft. Instead, both he and large chunks of his shattered plane fell to the ground. There, local farmers and curious onlookers surrounded Powers. Within hours, he was on his way to Moscow and the notorious Lubyanka prison. It was May Day, the day commemorating the international labor movement and a national holiday. As Khrushchev stood on a reviewing platform, watching the enormous May Day parade, the commander of Soviet air defenses hurriedly approached and informed him that an American aircraft had been shot down. At noon on May 1st, telephones across Washington started ringing. The CIA team in Norway alerted headquarters that the plane was long overdue. The duty officer informed Bissell, Defense Secretary Gates, the State Department Intelligence Bureau, and the chiefs of staff of each of the armed services. The news of the plane's downing crackled across Washington, hampering the ability of the White House to control the story. The CIA also contacted General Goodpaster, who had the unenviable job of calling Eisenhower at Camp David to inform him that a U-2 plane was missing and likely downed over the USSR. Eisenhower immediately boarded the helicopter for the flight back to Washington. Bissell convened a meeting that afternoon at the project headquarters on 8th Street in Washington. He said later he felt a sense of disaster about the entire affair. As well he might. By his own mission, the CIA was not well prepared for what happened. Bissell hastily dusted off the cover plan he had prepared in the event of a lost U-2 plane. NASA would announce that a high-altitude weather craft flying out of Adana, Turkey, had gone missing. Such a thin cover story could work only if the pilot died in the crash and if the plane's self-destruct mechanism had been triggered. On May 3rd, this cover story was sent out to the press, which did not express much interest in the lost weather plane. In Moscow, Khrushchev savored the moment. His son recalled that he was extraordinarily pleased. He had finally gotten his revenge on the people who had been offending him for such a long time. In his memoir, Khrushchev described how irritated the Soviets had been by the overflights, despite repeated protests. "The Americans gloated over our impotence and continued to violate the sovereignty of the USSR." Khrushchev stayed quiet while the interrogation of the pilot continued. He planned to lay a trap while the Americans tied their own hands by repeating these falsehoods. At the right moment, he would reveal the plane and the pilot to the world. Eisenhower had surrounded himself with talented, dedicated staff who served him well across many trying hours. But during the U-2 crisis, they performed poorly. The handling of that critical international situation, good pastor confessed many years later, was about as clumsy, in my opinion, as anything our government has ever done. The mistakes derived from a failure to anticipate answers to obvious questions. What if a plane was shot down? What if the pilot survived? What if the film was recovered?